Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. President Trump's foreign policy has been best characterized by his campaign slogan, America First. That policy has been articulated as one where the U.S.'s allies and trading partners are no longer taking advantage of the U.S. and national security, trade deals, or multinational treaties that allegedly harm American interests. This has resulted in the U.S. under the Trump administration pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, the Iranian nuclear deal, and a renegotiation of NAFTA, just to name a few. So how's America First working out? Well, my guest's latest book title neatly sums up his position, The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. James M. Lindsay is a senior vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations, where he oversees the work of over six dozen fellows at the Council's David Rockefeller Studies Program. He served in a variety of roles at the Council over the years, and also served as the inaugural director of the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also served as a deputy director and senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He was a director for global issues and multilateral affairs and the staff of the National Security Council in the 1990s and served as a consultant to the Hart-Rudman Commission on National Security. Again, he's written widely on various aspects of American foreign policy. His latest book, The Empty Throne, is co-authored with Ambassador Ivo Dalder, which was released back in October. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and I spoke with him while he was here. Dr. Lindsay, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. I'm delighted to be here.
In your most recent book with Ivo Dalder, you've written that Donald Trump made a wager when he became president that the U.S. could benefit from the world it helped create without the burdens of actually leading it. How do you think that wager is working out?
I don't think it's working out that well, but I think, Rich, you probably should step back and unpack that a bit. I think, understand Donald Trump. Donald Trump came to office arguing that he would do different things in foreign policy and do them differently. He said he would do that because he believed that much of America's woes, very real woes, could be attributed to the fact that the United States for 70 years had tried to lead the world. And President Trump has shifted the focus from leading others into winning. And as you know, Rich, leading implies beating. And the president clearly has been disruptive. He takes great pride in that. However, his disruption has not produced the kinds of big wins he promised, in my great concern, and it's reflected in the book I wrote with Ambassador Dalder, The Empty Throne, is that the president's actions are having the broad effect of undermining or eroding problems that exist out there in the international arena that are going to make the United States both less secure and less prosperous.
Give us an example of some of those problems in your mind.
Okay, well, let's acknowledge that President Trump didn't inherit a clean plate. The president was very fond when he first became president of talking about how he had inherited a mess. And there are numerous challenges out there in the world.
But if I can stop you, every president generally inherits a mess somewhere.
And I'm sure Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Dwight Eisenhower all would have said, I inherited a mess too. But I want to be fair here. I don't want to have the conversation come off as saying that somehow things were working and then Donald Trump broke it. I think what happened, you know, with President Trump, he has on a variety of issues tried to do things differently, and we haven't seen the big payoff. We can go through a long laundry list, but let me take two examples, one from the security arena and one from the trade arena. Let's look at a security issue. Let's look at North Korea. North Korea has been, for a number of years, building nuclear weapons. The president was critical of his predecessors for not taking care of the problem. I can certainly understand that. It would have been great.
And this has been an issue going back four presidencies, too.
All the way back to the presidency of George H.W. Bush.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a longstanding problem. The president's approach to it first was in year one of his presidency to talk a lot about exercising the big stick. Talked about Little Rocket Man, Fire and Fury, really sort of raising the impression that he might actually use military force to change the status quo. Year two, the president switches to a diplomatic approach, and now all of a sudden we had the summit in Singapore, and the president emerged from that talking up Kim Jong-un, saying the threat from North Korea no longer existed. The reality is that threat still exists. North Korea still has its nuclear weapons. It is not tested, that is true. That's good news. But the North Koreans can continue, and as best we can tell, are continuing to develop their nuclear program and their ballistic missile program, so they have missiles they have confidence in can hit the United States. So that's one area in which the president talked about doing things differently and hasn't produced the results that he has proclaimed. Let's look, I'll take trade. The president has been hostile U.S. trade policy for a long time. He blames it unfairly, in my estimation, for many of America's economic woes. But to take one, he went after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. He threatened to withdraw from NAFTA, which again involves the United States, Canada, and Mexico. We had protracted negotiations to produce a new agreement called, the administration calls it, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, UMSCA, USMCA, excuse me. And the president has trumpeted this as a great deal. When you actually look at the deal, what you discover is that we did a whole heck of a lot of negotiating and didn't accomplish a whole lot with it. A lot of people in the trade space now refer to President Trump's NAFTA agreement as NAFTA 0.8 or NAFTA 1.1. Depending on what you think, it made things a little bit worse or a little bit better. But it wasn't a significant change. Indeed, much of what is in the revised NAFTA agreement was actually already in the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. This was the trade agreement, of course, the president famously walked out of on day three of his presidency. And the significance of this protracted negotiation over NAFTA is that the Canadians now have a minister for diversification. What is the purpose of his job? To find other places to send Canadian goods. Other than the United States. And so this gets us into the broader sort of issue that a number of the president's policies, and they may sound good, but they are actually working against American economic interests.
Now, I was going to ask about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yep. I think the other part of the United States pulling out of that is most of the nations have gone ahead and negotiating and going ahead without the United States.
No. Well, exactly.
What impact does that have?
Well, it has a significant impact. You know, there's a saying among diplomats, Rich, which is that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Okay, and I think we're seeing a little bit about this. Let's just look specifically at TPP. Now, the argument for the Trans-Pacific Partnership was twofold. One was an economic argument. This is a way to get other economies to open themselves up to U.S. exports and U.S. investment. It would have cut tariffs on something like 18,000 goods, so American producers would have had better access to the other 11 member countries. There was also a strategic argument that by bringing essentially 40% of the global economy together to set rules, this would put pressure on China to have to adapt to our rules rather than vice versa. The president walks away from it, again, on day three of his presidency without a plan B. And again, in retrospect, as you well know, the president has put China in the crosshairs of his policy, but in some sense, he forfeited one of the great levers, pieces of leverage he had at the outset of his presidency. As you noted in your question, the other members of the TPP, the so-called TPP 11, didn't just give up. They went and negotiated a variant of the agreement just for themselves, and we're now seeing the impact of it. And I can give you lots of examples, but one in particular. If you are an American pork farmer, someone raises hogs, and you were looking at TPP, it was going to give you access to the Japanese market. You'd be selling into the Japanese market, more than 120 million people, big market. They like pork. And you'd be going in at a price discount relative to other pork exporters, particularly the Europeans, but also pork exporters in Australia, New Zealand, and the like. What has happened now is the United States is not part of TPP. Japan turned around, has reached an agreement with the Europeans. It's part of the so-called TPP-11. And so now you see American pork farmers seeing that they don't have a price advantage over other exporters. They're at a disadvantage, and they're losing considerable market share. That's one example. We can multiply that time and time again.
One of the things you've said is there's been a big beneficiary from the United States' America First policy, which goes back to, you know, the Paris Accords. It goes to TPP. It goes to a variety of multilateral agreements that this administration has stepped back from. Who is the biggest beneficiary in your view?
The biggest beneficiary, Rich, is China. And to see why, you have to understand what is the great advantage the United States had besides its raw power. The fact is it had lots of friends. The Chinese have a few clients. We have lots of friends and allies. And those friends and allies have been force multipliers. They've worked with us on a number of issues, and indeed many of the institutions you talk about that were created under U.S. leadership after the end of World War II embedded U.S. interest and reflected American values. So the reaction you saw to China, let's say beginning early on in the Trump presidency, and when the president announced that he was leaving the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was one of glee. From their point of view, the United States had, for those people who are big fans of soccer, the U.S. had scored an own goal. It had basically made a mistake and given China a great opening. Because from China's point of view, it then was able to wrap itself as a protector of this order, which it actually hasn't been, and then play the game of divide and conquer and say, look at us, we're trying to play by the rules. It's not China that's the bad actor. It's the United States of America that is the bad actor. And that game of divide and conquer is showing some progress for the Chinese.
Where have you seen progress?
Well, you clearly see it, I think, on the issues of trade, where many people look at the administration, the Trump administration, and say, yes, China may be exploiting the rules, but we're more worried about the fact that the Trump administration seems to be in the process of threatening the very rules of the international trading system, and that it is doing so without any overarching strategic plan. Case in point, I just got back from being in Germany, and you see this throughout Europe, a matter of being perplexed that the United States would impose tariffs on its closest friends and allies on the import of steel and aluminum on the grounds that those imports threatened U.S. national security. Think about that. Getting steel coming across the border from Canada represents a threat to the United States. And again, President Trump continues to say not only is he happy that he imposed those tariffs, but that he may extend them. And there's a lot of talk about slapping tariffs on imports of automobiles into the United States.
Especially from the South, Mexico, right, which assembles a lot of cars. Right.
But also, you know, from the Japanese and the Germans. And you look at that, and again, I don't think most Americans think that driving a Mercedes or a Mazda represents a national security threat. So what you're seeing in that case is that our friends are looking at us and questioning the judgment of the policies that we're pursuing, or the wisdom of the policies we're pursuing.
Now, in addition to just taking the lead in trade negotiations, has China taken advantage in other ways where we've stepped back?
Well, clearly the Chinese are pushing a very broad effort at multiple international institutions to influence the course of debate, because they're doing the one thing that really matters in diplomacy. They're showing up, and they're showing up in numbers. So you have the United States, which is a number of junctures sort of pulling itself out of international institutions, or not actually coming to an international institution with a well-defined policy. The Chinese are showing up, rolling up their sleeves, and going to work. They're building allies. And I will note that according to recent news reports, our national security advisor, John Bolton, has expressed frustration at how successful the Chinese have been at various international fora pushing a Chinese agenda. And he's now trying to figure out a way for the United States to counter that. But in some sense, the Chinese taking advantage of this opportunity was easily foreseeable 2 or 3 years ago. Indeed, it was foreseen by a lot of people. And again, I would look, you know, when we talk about the consequences long term of the Trump administration, I think one of them is going to be the great harm that has been done to the State Department. We have a tendency in our foreign policy to over-militarize it. No disrespect at all to the United States military, finest men and women, finest organization in the world. But our diplomats are also quite good. But this is an administration that has sought to cut the budget for the State Department by about 30%. It has actually been resisted by Republican-controlled Congress in doing so. But it's also basically sort of locked out most career diplomats. So what you're seeing is a hemorrhaging of talent at the State Department, people who are really good deciding that they cannot work in this system, which doesn't want to give them a role. And you're sort of seeing a hollowing out of our diplomacy. And I think that will have long-term consequences because it actually helps to know how to make things happen. I mean, diplomats play an incredibly important role. We as Americans tend not to notice it unless, of course, you're in Barcelona and lose your wallet, you're in Paris
or something screws
and
up.
Lose your passport.
And the other thing is that if something screws up, yeah. I mean, then it's the diplomat's fault.
Yeah, so I think there's institutionally within the United States reason to have great concern over the impact of the Trump administration.
My guest today is Dr. James Lindsay. He's a senior vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's co-author with Ivo Dalder of The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership, and he'll be talking about that subject to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on America Alone, the Consequences of America First. A lot of people in intellectual circles, foreign policy professionals, people who sort of follow trade very closely, I think there's a tendency to think of this as sort of an interregnum, that once the Trump administration's over, we can go back to the way things used to be. Is there a danger in that sort of thinking?
Yes. I'm reminded of the wisdom of the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who said that you can't step into the same river twice. I don't think there is any going back. I do think that the next presidency represents a chance to do things differently. It's unclear who the next president is going to be or when
we'll
there will
have
be
it,
a
yeah,
next
I mean,
president.
Maybe 5 years from now.
So it's hard to say what the lay of the land will look like in the world. If history teaches us anything, it is that events can change very rapidly. Just compare what Europe looked like in October of 1989 versus October of 1990. So I think we have to be humble in making predictions about the future. I do think two things are worth flagging here. One is that for the United States to succeed, I do think it needs to redevelop working with others, particularly our close friends and allies. But that's also going to mean renegotiating the bargain we have with them. Not all of President Trump's criticisms are misplaced. Indeed, that gets to my second point. As I look at President Trump, in some ways he's done people a great favor. He, in a sense, showed America's friends and allies what a world without American leadership would look like. Think of it as a version of A Christmas Carol with the ghosts of Christmas future. And I think, you know, in allied capitals, they actually got the message from President Trump that he wanted them to do more. And this gets us to a central irony of the Trump presidency. Trump campaigned saying our friends and allies hadn't done enough. He, through his rhetoric, persuaded them that he meant that they should do more. They then started to step up to the plate on trade, on defense, a variety of other issues. And President Trump's administration hasn't been interested in mobilizing them or picking them up on their offer. We can see that in two places in particular. One is in the challenge posed by China. Most of our allies agree that China is basically exploiting the rules of the trading game. They have come to the administration and said, we're willing to work with you. The administration's answer has been, no thanks, we got this. Okay? Second thing, I would look at the issue of the Iran nuclear deal. The president pointed to a number of problems with the deal. They exist. I don't even think the supporters deny that. There's just a question of trade-off between costs and benefits. But the president said he wanted more constraints on Iranian behavior, particularly behaviors not covered by that deal. Well, the Germans, the British, the French came up with a bunch of ideas. Chancellor Merkel came to Washington to speak to the president. President Macron came to Washington to speak to the president. Boris Johnson came on the behalf of British Prime Minister Theresa May with ideas about what we could do jointly to put more pressure.
But within the confines of that agreement,
within
correct?
The confines of that agreement. Yeah. But in essence, they were taking the administration very seriously. The president didn't even bother to convene a meeting of his National Security Council staff to assess these ideas. In essence, the answer was, we're leaving this and we expect you to come with us as well. And that's actually created a fundamental divide in the transatlantic alliance. And I think for anyone who spends time traveling overseas and going to places like Berlin or France or Tokyo or London, there's a great deal of concern that there is a rift in our relations. We've had crises before. I don't want to somehow paint the notion the past was this wonderful place, meadows and sunflowers. But in the past, we had differences over policy. Here, I think what we're seeing are differences over purpose. And that's a fundamental difference. And again, the conversations you hear in Europe are, is the transatlantic relationship dead? Is this over? What role should Europe play if the United States is going to turn inward or turn in another direction? Those are profound questions that may produce answers that we Americans find incredibly disheartening.
Let me ask you a question that gets to some of the consequences of that approach. At the Munich Security Conference this last year, and most international gatherings where there are representatives of the administration there, there are also other representatives of the United States, sometimes congressional leadership, sometimes former leaders. And certainly at the Munich Security Conference, where there was a unified opposition to the administration's ideas of how security is going to work, you had the Trump administration saying this, congressional leaders, former leaders, some who may be running for president now, said, hey, don't worry, we've got this. We'll, you know, this is a phase, it's going to pass. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing for American leadership that you have, and it really points up to our sort of divided notion of who should be governing the United States. You have both sides going and saying, hey, those guys are only going to be there a little while. When we get back in power, it's all going to be hunky-dory. And then, you know, it leads to a situation where both sides are doing that for the whoever's out of power. Do you think that is a good thing or a bad thing overall?
Well, Rich, I'm glad you raised the issue of the Munich Security Conference. And I want to get to your specific question in a moment. But first, I just want to note, I think in years to come, historians may look back at that conference as the turning point in the future of the transatlantic relationship. Because I would say that sort of mood in Europe up until this year toward President Trump has been one that's been described as don't isolate President Trump, don't give in to President Trump, don't give up on President Trump. And I think what we saw at the Munich Security Conference this year were Europeans, in essence, signaling they're giving up on President Trump. I just came back from another trip to Tokyo. I talked to senior Japanese officials, and the theme I heard from them is, we will not be able to work with this administration. Our hope is to manage relations for the next year and a half, 2 years, and then there'll be a new administration and new possibilities will exist. Now on your issue about what was said at the Munich Security Conference by the American delegation, I will note two things is that President Trump is, one, often at war with members of Congress, including members of his own party. Two, President Trump is often at war with members of his own administration. And that has produced a bit of incoherence in U.S. foreign policy, which is not good. You have instances in which the people the president has appointed to key national security positions speak, but it's clear in retrospect they're not speaking for the president. Perhaps the best example might be Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, an immensely capable gentleman, who was quoted as suggesting that the United States had ways to talk to the North Koreans. This was back, I guess, in 2017. And the president immediately responded on Twitter, basically telling the Secretary of State to save his effort because it wasn't going to work. Those sort of things have real consequences for diplomacy. The other thing in term, and I think if you look at the administration, the people who in his administration who sort of stood up to the president, those people have either been fired or have left. Most obvious example and perhaps the most important one was Secretary of Defense James Mattis, who famously resigned last December, in essence saying that his view of the world was fundamentally incompatible with the president's. And so you have an administration that's often fighting with itself. But at the same time, the president's often fighting with members of Congress, again, with both parties, which is really interesting. We talk about how the days of bipartisanship are gone, and certainly on domestic politics, it looks that way. It is, you know, it's red team, blue team, all's fair in love and war. But on foreign policy and a couple of key issues, there's a fair amount of bipartisanship. I would say in dealing with Russia, Democrats and Republicans stand shoulder to shoulder. They're greatly concerned about the policies the Russians are pursuing, their interference in elections. That's why it was a Republican-controlled Congress that passed tougher sanctions on Russia, passed those sanctions over the objections of President Trump. Likewise, I think in terms of standing up to China, especially on the economic front, we see Democrats and Republicans standing shoulder to shoulder. But what's interesting here is they're standing shoulder to shoulder on Capitol Hill, but they're also either in opposition to the president or critical of how the president is handling things. And obviously, from the vantage point of having an effective foreign policy, that can make it much, much harder to do.
Get back to your central point that from the Munich Security Conference that Europe and the other leading democracies have given up on working with this administration.
I would rephrase it as leaning toward giving up. I don't want to give up on them.
Okay. Where do they turn? To themselves? To another nation to provide leadership?
Well, that's part of the challenge. As you look around, what are the alternatives? And they're frightening. But I will note that there are two possible outcomes if the United States chooses not to play its traditional role of mobilizing others. And let me make clear that leadership does not mean military adventurism. Indeed, if you think sort of the great mistakes of American foreign policy, most notably Iraq, that was not required by the demands of American leadership. In fact, we invaded Iraq over the bitter protests of our closest friends and allies, many of whom said this was a very bad idea, and in retrospect, it appears they were correct. I think when you're talking about this notion of leading others to handle common challenges, and there are a lot of them because of globalization, if we don't do it, two possibilities. One is that nobody does it. There's no requirement that problems get solved. You could go through a period in world politics that is less orderly, more chaotic. That's likely to be a world that is less secure and less prosperous. Now, the president sometimes talks about even if bad things happen, we'll do better than others. And that's probably true. But I'm not sure that's a standard most people want to use. They want to do better than they've done before, not do better than somebody else has done. Those are different things. The other possibility is that Chinese will succeed in supplanting the United States as the country that has the greatest influence on global rules and procedures. I think that would be inimical, harmful to America's interests and values. The Chinese have no reason to want to create a set of rules that help us. That's not how they see the world. They're going to create a set of rules that tilt the playing field toward them. And again, you talk to many Chinese and they scratch their head and are surprised that the United States would give up sort of the perks of being sort of the most influential player in the room in a fit of what they would call pique, because they see this as a system that really rebounds to America's advantage.
If that first scenario you mentioned comes to pass, that nobody steps up,
yep.
Does that weaken a lot of other institutions, say like the EU, you know, where every country goes their own way in a way?
Yes, and that could be the case. And we may actually go back to the world that the greatest generation tried to save us from. When I talk about American leadership, okay, we can have lots of arguments about how to exercise it, the balance of diplomacy versus force. Indeed, for 70 years, we had very vigorous arguments between the two parties, within the two parties, over how to do things. But there was this consensus that if we wanted things to get done, it was better to have friends and allies. They were force multipliers. And the only thing that was going to get people going was us, because we were, to borrow the phrase popularized during the Clinton administration, the indispensable nation. We were the country that could mobilize others to act. If we leave that world, it could be a less secure world. And again, think of the problem that Harry Truman, George C. Marshall, Dean Acheson, and the others who were in office in the late 1940s faced. They were shaped by the world, the history they had lived. And what that history had taught them was, number one, that Americans would tell themselves that they didn't have to worry about problems over there. That's what they told themselves after World War I. That's what they told themselves right up until the moment the bombs fell at Pearl Harbor. Their conclusion is America can't escape being involved, so we need to be involved in a smart way. The second thing that the greatest generation, that leadership cohort after the end of World War II, thought and looked at was, we have to ward off nationalism. We have to ward off sort of intense dog-eat-dog geopolitical and geoeconomic competition. They're trying to find ways to sort of tamp down the kind of nationalistic, short-sighted policies that sowed the seeds for conflict. They were trying to avoid a third world war. History suggests they were right and did a heck of a job.
Dr. James Lindsay is a senior vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who addressed the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on America Alone, the Consequences of America First. His most recent book is titled The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership, which he co-authored with Ambassador Ivo Dalder, which was released back in October. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.